You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. It is the 11th of March, 2020. And as always, I thank my donors to this show and continue to ask your support, especially now, since I do have some unfortunate tax. I just spent a huge amount of money paying some back taxes, but unfortunately, it's not sufficient. Not to mention many other problems. And one of these days we'll get my hot water back. But that's okay. You try to lead the ascetic life, these kind of things happen. Speaking of the ascetic life, I want to talk about the Russian monarchy, the Russian crown, the restoration, the nature of the anointing and the sacramental concept or not of the anointing of the monarch. And this is extremely important. I believe it's taken me a long time to come to this point of view, but it is a bit of a myth. There's a story that there's an anathema attached to anyone who revolts against the Romanov crown. And this came from the election of Michael, 1613. Comes from the very end of the time of troubles. There's a claim that this anathema is actually of ancient Byzantine origin, but in fact the text of this comes from Peter the First, and of course the atheist Feofan Prokopovich around 1721. The earliest full version of this we could find is 1766. And this mythical anathema comes from the period of time where the old believers were calling Peter the Great the Antichrist, or an Antichrist, which of course they were absolutely right. Now, St. Tigon had this anathema removed to the extent that it was real at all, not from the time of troubles, but from Peter the Great in the Synod of 1917-18. And it did remove this, did not come from the time of troubles, but it does come from Peter. So, and the reason I mention this, as odd as this might be, is that really there was much in the Roman. You know, I've gotten in some trouble from monarchists attacking the 18th century, but as a historian, I have to tell the truth. It was an absolute disaster. It was a breaking of the succession. And to think that there's an anathema for, not following orthodoxy or mixing with foreigners, and yet everything like that happened in the 18th century. But even before the revolution, Russian theologians believe that the anointing of a monarch is something like the consecration of a bishop or even the anointing of somebody after baptism. Even N.S. Suvorov talks about this, that it's something where the anointing provides the gifts of the Holy Spirit proper to ruling. Now, this happened in Byzantium, and it happened in the West, too. There's nothing Russian about it. I think the big difference is that in Russia, it was very similar to the post-baptismal rite. But it's even more than that. There's even a group that says that, that there's a sacred blood to the royal family, that, that, somehow this grace can be genetically, passed down, which of course is what the 1613 anathema is all about. Now, you know, it's understood that the soul can be found in the blood, as Leviticus 11 says. The notion that the blood is higher than the flesh, but lower than the soul, something like that. But any talk of the sacred royal blood is problematic. You're talking about heredity here, not the soul. The so-called approved testament of the Sobor of 1613. Michael's claim to the throne stemmed from his coming from the root of Tsar Fyodor, the former great noble and pious god-crowned Russian monarch, as from his noble root, root meaning, of course, his family. And it says, and former kings chosen by God, these pious roots were kept before pious and great sovereign Tsar and great Grand Duke Fyodor Ivanovich, autocrat of all Russia. The center of all righteousness was ended in him, completed in him. The place of God, this royal authority, on you, Mikhail, lays as if by property peculiar to the royal seed of God, the chosen root. Now, the very election, the first of the Romanovs, is justified by one thing, that he is a distant relative of Tsar Fyodor, the great miracle worker. But the notion of electing Mikhail in the hope that he'll inherit the piety of the last member of the Rurikid branch as this guarantee of the people from evil is a bit of an issue. When there have been royalist publications, royal blood for every monarchist is a shrine, you can read. And that this blood itself contains the justification for succession, for truth, for righteousness. But we know that this can't possibly be true. Orthodox Church has no such doctrine that the blood of one family or another has an inherent right to rule. There's nothing sacred about heredity. Especially if it's just one family and it gives them this very specific right to rule. But even if it had one time received a legitimate election, the prophet Isaiah says, a shoot will come out of the stump of Jesse. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. Isaiah 11. But then Paul says, if part of the dough offered as first fruits is holy, then the whole batch is holy. If the root, so are the branches, from Romans. In other words, it can't just be one family. It has to be the entire nation. The root, of course, here is the same thing of blood, and that means heredity. It has nothing to do with the soul, has nothing to do with grace. But the theme that this can directly determine a dynasty. Remember, the Byzantines never knew any kind of dynastic rule, having existed for more than a millennium. They had many dynasties, but there was no such concept as you may only have one, and if you revolt against it, you're gonna burn. You had entire dynasties in Byzantium that were heretics, like the Isaurians, or at least most of them. But the minute they began to become more dynastic, like the Palaiologi, they become uniates, and they eventually lead to the death of the state. Now, as much of a monarchist as I've always been and always will be, the dynastic form coming from the Old Testament is a really bad idea. In 1 Samuel, of course, they forget that you know, Saul was elected and fell. And of course, Solomon was the archetypal heretic. So John Chrysostom says this, talking about Saul. He says, Samuel announces to Saul that he'll defeat the Amalekites, curse everything from them, spare no one. He did not obey. He spared the king of Agag and the herd of small and large cattle. Samuel, having come and saw this, was angry, said the Lord doesn't want burnt offerings and sacrifices, but to listen to his voice. This obedience is better than sacrifice. At the same time, he threatened him, and he threatened with taking the kingdom away. This is the failure to fulfill the divine order. It became a curse. In other words, the Davidic dynasty, if that's the basis for any dynastic rule in Russia or anywhere in the Christian world, the only thing that matters about it really is that Christ came from it. But it certainly is not, it has nothing to do with the truth. Let's be clear, the point I'm trying to make here is a relatively simple one. The anathema claims, and this comes up all the time, that any rejection of a Romanov monarch into eternity, it says, is met with pure anathema and rejection. But note what that implies. It implies that there is something about the blood or the heredity of the Romanov family that's different from everything else. It has a special grace and charism to rule. There's something about the blood, the family, that has this inherent right to rule the Christian state, and that there is a theological punishment for rejecting this idea. And the argument I'm making is that that can't be true. It didn't come from the time of troubles. It came from the reign of Peter. So much of the troubles era was destroyed during Peter's reign. The first full text of that comes from the 18th century, not from 1613. It comes from Feofan Prokopovich, the heretic, at least atheist at most, head of the church under Peter the Great, is the one who actually wrote this and enforced this. It was removed by the 1918 synod anyway. That this is false. That there is no concept of dynasticism in orthodoxy, and not even in the Old Testament. Because you can only talk about David, and in that case, you have, you know, essentially, of the first three, two of them fell badly, and those from the divided kingdom overwhelmingly were awful, with a few exceptions, people like Josiah. But even, you know, including the notion of having a dynasty, of course, does not exist. There is no dynasty. Serbia may be somewhat of an exception, but there's no theological reason for that. In Byzantium, you know, initially when the Christian monarchy was founded, they focused entirely on the pious Israelite kings for religious issues, but the Roman order for state and legal issues. It's alien to the Roman idea as well as the Christian idea. Tikhomirov, wrote the idea of the emperor as head of the executive branch of the state, on the contrary, requires a man of extraordinary ability, the most capable of the country. That was the Roman idea. But that's completely incompatible with heredity. It's impossible to think that in one generation, miraculously, a brilliant man will be repeated every generation. The idea of God's servant does not imply indispensable heredity. And that's the point here. There is no dynasticism in orthodoxy or in common sense. You have the idea that You know, somehow monarchists are claiming that the church teaches that Russian monarchs, somehow they're anointed by the oil, that somehow this grace is hereditary. And they have this lordship to develop and govern both church and state. And that comes from not just from the anointing, but it also, according to them, has to come from the blood that they carry. There is no such teaching and no relation to a monarch anywhere in the Christian world. But the notion that there's any hereditary grace is shocking. But you do come across this. In the Old Testament, the most racially pure tribe, which was Levi, was called to the priesthood. Now, that hereditary priesthood was canceled. It's one of the things from the Old Testament that was canceled in the New. It's in the Old Testament, and Christ didn't explicitly cancel it, then it still exists. Now, the New Testament priesthood is different because each candidate now is examined not from the point of view of his bloodline, but from who he is. And still, somehow, I made it. Remember, I told the man who ordained me, I said, boy, you're a bad judge of character. But if that's the case with monarchs, I'm sorry, with priests, then it's certainly the case with monarchs. It's a perfect parallel. The Old Testament monarchy is dynastic, however poorly done. The New Testament is closer to the Roman principle of personal mobility. In late Byzantium and Old Russia, there was a bit of a deviation from this correct understanding. But of course, destruction followed. So, to talk about the oaths of the Russian people at the Sobor of 1613 and the Romanov family, this is falsehood. And it's been canceled anyway. But it does not come from that Sobor. One of the big problems with the Petrian era is that he collected all the documents he could from Russia and burned them. He was trying to create a revolution starting from scratch, but of course you can't do that everywhere. You can only go so far there. But even the Synod in 1913, the Holy Synod in 1913 in Russia, the celebration of the 300th anniversary of the dynasty, announced that the oath extends almost to the last judgment. The decisions of that Sobor are firm and indestructible until the end of time. But even if that oath of allegiance were true, that founded the dynasty in 1613, it is very conditional, and of course the Romanovs don't even meet those conditions. So that can't be true anyway. You know, you hear Russian monarchists all the time say that you have to be, if you're Russian, you have to be a royalist because of the 1613 anathema. That bound all Russians to be royalists, and you have to be a Romanov royalist. But the Romanovs, of course, themselves didn't follow the strictures of that oath. Because for one thing, they have to maintain the faith pure, which unfortunately the Romanovs did not do. We could talk about the old believers issue, or Peter, or the dreaded 18th century, where the Russian monarchy and the church was destroyed briefly, or at least cut off from its roots briefly. The oath was terminated because neither the church, or I mean, when I say the church, I mean the men, the human part of it, not the old believers maintained it. The priestly old believers maintained it anyway. Grace was always present there, but it doesn't mean it didn't exist elsewhere. But I'm talking about the human side, not the grace-filled side. The Romanovs nor the churchmen did not fulfill the conditions. The faith was not maintained as before, which is absolutely essential for that oath. Monarchists talk about this all the time. That oath does not show up in any of my writings, and I think there's a reason for that. But Peter the Great alone is a violation of that oath. And of course, his successor, I'm not going to call her by her fake, you know, dynastic name, but Marta Skowronska, who, as far as anyone can tell, is a Polish woman. Or from Lithuania, I should say. I've mentioned her before, so-called Catherine I, which is a mockery of the monarchy, mockery of monarchy in general, monarchy of the church, a mockery of Russia. That was Peter the Great's spitting on the throne, having a literal whore who he may or may not have been married to. She was just some surf girl that he found on the battlefield. His officers passed her around for a few days. And I guess he was interesting. She was interesting to him. Sort of married her and made her his successor. This is part of the reason why I think that a new man came from the great embassy, because he had a wonderful, very pious, very good woman, Eudoxia, who he tortured and got rid of, didn't even recognize when he came back. So I'm pretty sure that violates the oath. Not to mention, the oath also refers to mixing with foreigners. And mixing with foreigners is equal to heresy. The Romanovs have mixed with them to an extreme degree. I mean, you know, Ivan the Sixth, Peter the Third, Catherine the Second. Of course, you know, Skowronskaya, obviously. They ceased to be Romanovs at that time. In fact, they became the Dukes of Holstein, or Holstein-Gottorp. Peter the Second, who was the son of the Tsarevich Alexei, who Peter murdered, partially proving that he probably wasn't his father. Peter the Second died in 1730. He would have been Peter's grandson. That ended the Romanov male line. Now, he was succeeded by Anna the First, who was the daughter of Peter the Great's half-brother, Ivan the Fifth. Now, before she died in 1740, that so-called empress declared that her grandnephew, Ivan the Sixth, should succeed her. Now, that was an attempt to exclude the descendants of Peter from inheriting the throne. Now, Ivan the Sixth was only a baby at the time. I've spoken about him before. And his parents, the Grand Duchess Anna, who have also, you know, the second Anna, and Anthony Ulrich of Brunswick, the ruling regent, who were absolutely detested, because this is where people like Byron were brought in. Until the light in the darkness, Elizabeth Petrovna, who was a legitimized daughter of Peter I, gained the favor of the population, and she dethroned Ivan VI in a coup. And of course, the ambassadors of France and Sweden backed her too. And I've also spoken about how what happened to poor Ivan VI, that he was essentially tortured to death and his parents in prison for many years. One of the great tragedies and sins of the horrible 18th century in Russia. But the Holstein-Gottorps retained the so-called Romanov surname really just for propaganda purposes. But there is a somewhat of a matrilineal descent from Peter through Anna. Anna Petrovna, who was Peter I's elder daughter by, you know, the Polish woman. But in 1742, the Elizabeth of Russia brought Anna's son, her nephew, Peter of Holstein, to St. Petersburg and proclaimed him heir. And then, of course, she eventually married him off to Sophia of Anhalt, Zerbst. So it became very much a Germanic dynasty. The Romanov name was used in almost a dishonest way. Now, in the reign of the great Tsar Nicholas, Alexander III and Nicholas II redeemed all of this, and I've said this 1,000 times. Some of the laws of succession and marriage were changed. The marriage issue is of immense importance. Tatiana, the new martyr, married a Georgian. The Princess Tatiana married a Georgian Orthodox man who was killed in the war. and it was okay. No, I'm sorry. I don't mean the Grand Duchess. I don't mean Tsar Nicholas's daughter. I'm sorry. I mean Tatiana Konstantinovna, who died in 1979. She was the third child of the Grand Duke Constantine. Not to be confused with Tatiana. And part of the issue there was Alexander III modified the Romanov laws of succession, and he restricted the title of Grand Duchess to children only of the male line of the emperor. This gets very, very complicated. Tatiana was the great-granddaughter of Nicholas I, and so she was only a princess from birth. She was not called Imperial Highness, she was called just plain old Highness. Now, Tatiana married a Georgian Orthodox man, a good man who was killed in the war, and the laws were later changed. And Nicholas II changed this, that if you are a member of the royal family, you marry somebody without the corresponding rank, you can retain the title and privileges and the proper everything else with the exception of any rights to succession. Now, so that was changed later on. There are such things as equal marriages, which means you marry a member of one ruling house marries a member of another ruling house, then unequal marriages, married into an aristocrat who is not a member of a ruling house. So the very rules of succession in the Romanov line are in violation of the 1613 anathema. So, yeah, the point I'm trying to make is that none of the 1613 conditions were ever fulfilled by that family. So using that so-called anathema, which I firmly believe came from Peter anyway, but even if it didn't, has no force. And that just brings more weight on the disaster of the Romanovs, with the exception of there's several. I mean, I want to say, make an exception, of course, to Michael, much of Alexis, Elizabeth, no doubt, much of Nicholas I, despite his romantic attachment to the memory of Peter the Great, and of course Alexander III and Nicholas II. But the Council of 1613, remember, there was pure chaos in Russia. You had two countries invading it. You had aristocratic factions killing each other. You had no clear succession. But if there was any connection of the dynasty of Rurik, so-called, there were certainly many other people rather than Michael who had a vague connection to Rurik. And the relatives of at least two wives of Ivan IV, Gudinov's family, and of course, Glinsky, whom the mother of Ivan IV came. Those families certainly had it. So the Romanovs being, you know, special in that regard are groundless. Shushky was probably closer to that line than Michael was. So the election of Mikhail was done over any member of the Gudinov or Shushky family. The Romanovs were, really weren't that close to the Rurikid line and didn't differ in any kind of nobility of origin. Now, I don't want to claim that Vasily Shushky, or so-called Tsar Vasily IV, was legitimate. He was not. And he's not recognized, generally speaking, as a czar by monarchs. Every once in a while, you come across someone who likes him. But when Boris Godunov died, I've done a whole show on him some time ago. When Boris Godunov died, that was a legitimate monarch and a good monarch. His son, Fyodor Godunov, took his place. Shuisky, who had claimed that that the Dmitry of Uglik, who was the last surviving son of Ivan the Fourth, had killed himself, or had some sort of a fit and cut himself. He was the one who led that investigation. He changed his mind because he wanted Tsar Boris's place after he died. So all of a sudden he changes his mind on this and then goes so far as to claim that the pretender, the false Dmitry the First, was legitimate out of nowhere. So Shuisky, typical aristocrat, typical oligarch, I should say, completely switched his mind, switched his point of view when it benefited him. But then he changed his mind again and conspired against the false Dmitry and even brought about his death in 1606. Changed his mind again, saying, oh yes, the real Dmitry had in fact been slain and the reigning Tsar was an imposter. So his clan proclaimed him Tsar in 1606. And he reigned for 4 years. But even in Moscow, the city, he had very little authority. But the real founder was Fyodor Romanov, who is the future Patriarch Filaret. Filaret, who co-ruled with Michael, both a monk and his father, because he was forcibly sent to a monastery. Attempted to seize power before, but Boris Godunov had pushed him away. By 1600, Filaret was plotting against Tsar Boris, but Godunov, typical of him, was very mild. And once he was caught, he forced him into a monastery. As he was going through the monastic vows, Filaret answered no to all the questions. But he had a bunch of people saying yes for him, and they tonsured him anyway. They gave him the name Filaret. And he said, my monasticism is fake. But the Romanovs were really the only family that was subject to repression under Boris, but for good reason. Because they created rebellions around Moscow. And the Romanovs were the ones who created the rumors that the Tsarevich Dmitry had been miraculously saved from the knife. That was a so-called weak spot in the Godunov crown. So really, to some extent, the Romanovs have a hand in starting the troubles. Now, I could do a whole thing on Grigory Otrepiev, the so-called false Dmitry, who created this rebellion, actually ruled Russia for a while. But he wasn't alien to the Romanov family at all. He lived in their estates. He was a cell attendant of Patriarch St. Job. He was at the Miracles Monastery in Moscow. He was brought up as a man of royal blood. He had a real foundation. But even the Tsarevich Dmitry didn't, because he was an illegal descendant. That was a much later marriage of Ivan. He had no claim anyway, so I never understood why Dmitry was in the position he was. But after the death of Godunov and the extermination of the false Dmitry, Filaret, who had rejected his monasticism, was chosen as Metropolitan of Rostov. Now, the Metropolitan Cyril was driven out of that see by the false Dmitry and appointed Filaret. And now Ignatius, who was a Union, was made Patriarch by the pretender. But Filaret was the second person after Ignatius participated and supported the wedding of false Dmitry and Marina Mieszek, a Polish woman. Filaret then claimed the title of Patriarch, but there were still three living patriarchs, St. Job, Ignatius, and St. Hermogenes, the very saintly Hermogenes. So then the pretender is overthrown, the throne comes under Shuisky, who then appoints Philaret Patriarch, and then sends for the relics of the true Tsar, Mr. Dmitry. And then the Romanovs fall again for the second false Dmitry, who was Jewish, Verevkin. Then deprives, he recognizes the second imposter as a true Tsarevich, and as the Patriarch of all Russia, so-called, and he had rejected his own. Now, this is the founding of that family. But there was a legal patriarch. St. Hermogenes was still alive. So so Philaret is not just a state crime, but a church crime. And he created a schism and supported a rebellion. Patriarch Philaret blessed Mikhail Saltykov to conclude an agreement with Lithuania on the transfer of the throne to the Polish King Vladislav. I mean, Suski was a better option than Vladislav. Philaret was captured, but then forgiven yet again by the ruler. Forgiven both by Suski and Hermogenes. If you look at the cover of my book on medieval Russia, it's the picture of the Poles confronting St. Hermogenes in prison. He was one of the most inspiring martyr stories I've ever read. He was restored to the rank of metropolitan after that. So in 1610, he takes part in the conspiracy against Suski after his overthrow. He promoted his young son, Michael, to the throne. And this is how the time of troubles ended. This is not an auspicious beginning here. This is one of the reasons the Old Believers grew. I'm sorry, this is before the Old Believers. This is the foundation of the schism. One of the reasons the Old Believers grew as fast as they did is that you had these problems and you had this level of cynicism. It was a very shaky beginning. So by the time Nikon was around, you had, the grounds of a rebellion. Again, it's one of the reasons that Peter the Great, a bit later on, created this anathema. And even if the anathema is true in 1613, this is part of the reason why. If the anathema is in fact real, then it exists because of the very, very shaky beginnings of this family. Philaret became Metropolitan of Rostov under the false Dmitry, ordained by the Patriarch Ignatius. By the time Michael took over, all this was hushed up. Now, this has been done before in Russia. A lot of this research was done by people like Nazarov and the Union of the Russian People recently, but has not made it into English yet. But when Michael was elected and the Romanov family really began in earnest, all this was hushed up. So Peter trying to rewrite history, there's nothing really new about that. The fact that he supported, you know, both pretenders and he was treated so mercifully, all this was by two rulers that he tried to overthrow. And, you know, of course, the accession to the head of the church carried out by the false Dmitry II was recognized by Tsar Mikhail. Now, Tsar Mikhail was completely Orthodox. Alexei, we have a problem, even though he was a very pious and a very good man. He promoted, of course, Patriarch Nikon. But I never thought that really was the issue. I've always been a supporter of the Old Believers in many ways. But I do think the Old Believers became what they were because of Peter, not Nikon. The very existence of Catherine I ends a lot of the Orthodox respect for that line. So the anathema, real or fake, doesn't matter. It was violated at that point. Now, Catherine had 9 children, all from different men, of course, and God knows how many prior to that.
So Anna Ivanovna afterwards and Anna Leopoldovna. And you know, they had children, probably not from their stated fathers. Now, Catherine the Great didn't know whose son Paul was. Now, Paul was a saintly monarch, although was a foreigner. Until her death, she doubted the paternity of Paul. And the same thing goes then for Alexander I. Alexander II has his own set of problems. When he was a young man, he was in love with a courtly maid named Rozina, who was very quickly married off, and then with Maria Trubetskoy, and then he fell in love with Olga Kanonskaya, and even flirted with Queen Victoria, believe it or not. But he had chosen the Princess of Hesse as a bride, but still, his relationship with Maria Trubetskoy never ended. He even wanted to abdicate to marry her, which is, I think, somewhat well known. But in 1841, he married the Grand Duchess Maria Alexandrova, who was the daughter of Grand Duke Ludwig of Hesse, who then converted to Orthodoxy, became Maria Alexandrova. And so in December of 1840, she became, you know, she had the title of Imperial Highness. But even after his coronation, the emperor began to see a woman. Again, this is rumored, but a persistent rumor. Alexandra Dolgokhova, who in fact had far more of influence over him than his wife did. 1866, he began to see Ekaterina Dolgokhova, who died in 1922, who became very, very close to him, in fact, and settled in the Winter Palace and gave birth to illegitimate kids. So Alexander II, despite the good he did, was hardly an example. But both the crown and the church under the Romanovs were brought to a degenerate state, despite good people. And again, Elizabeth, of course, Nicholas II, his father, much of what Nicholas I did. Again, Nicholas I, you know, I go back and forth on. The Romanovs were hardly a sacred line, despite everything that Nicholas II did to redeem it. And he was a great man. Now, you can contrast that with, for example, the Kingdom of Nicaea in Byzantium. Now, I've done an entire, one of my favorite lectures I've done on here is my lecture on John Vitatis Doukas, who ruled the exile kingdom of Nicaea after the Crusaders took Byzantium, or Constantinople. These were populist kings. They were one with the people, quite literally. These were small kingdoms where the monarch was really in no better shape than the common person. Pope Innocent III made fun of him. And the Pope said how ridiculous it is that you live and rule in the forest, have a union with me, and I'll, you know, I'll bring you to glory. Anyway, he made fun of him by saying, you know, what kind of king rules in the forest, not in the capital? But John Doukas says, the emperor says, the king rules not with walls and towers, but faithful people. And the people of the faithful are those who, for the sake of preserving the truth, left the capital and gather in the forest. That was his reaction. This is the model of Orthodox kingship, and unfortunately isn't mentioned nearly as much as he should be. These are the folk kings of Nicaea, after the fall of Constantinople in 1204. These were extremely virtuous men because they were in such extreme conditions. these were similar. I mean, they were legitimate monarchs, of course, but these were also like Old Testament judges. These men were extremely virtuous rulers. You know, I did another lecture on Metropolitan Vitale, whose church I'm a member of. He said in 1993, and he said something, and I had forgotten he said this. Of course, I've done several lectures on this concept. He said that there were great attempts by various people and officers, generals and soldiers, to restore at least a shadow of a monarchy in Argentina, Chile, Paraguay, Spain, and Portugal. Now, I've made this argument since I was in college. So Metropolitan Vitale, in 93, said that the military governments in Latin America and Western Europe give at least the outlines of a monarchy. Now, of course, he's talking about Perón, Pinochet, Stroessner, Franco, Salazar, are firmly nationalist, and all of them, Christian rulers. And certainly better off than most of the Romanovs were. And I think it's very interesting that Vitale and the Senate abroad made that comment. And that was in an official pamphlet supporting the monarchy. Now, because of the issue of this so-called anathema and what the Romanovs, generally speaking, were, and I want to be clear, this has nothing to do with I'm a firm monarchist, but I generally accept the old believer's point of view politically. I have a book out on that topic, Sobornosti, which is a variant of Sobornos, which I chose for a specific reason. And I translated a few essays. By the first edition of that book, there's an error. My editor said that it was from Anonymous. That was from me. If you have that book and it says by Anonymous, that's me. My editor made an error, and somehow, I'm not a man of detail, I missed it. I keep forgetting to mention that. I think I mentioned it years ago. But it's okay. But I also was the first to translate some of their more modern political thinking into English. And I was very, you know, green in the language back then. I hope I did them justice. But M.V. Nazarov wrote a book called Who's the Heir to the Russian Throne? And he deals with a lot of these topics in very depressing detail. And the heir to the throne is something that I've avoided partially for these reasons. Because again, there's nothing special about the Romanov family. But the other important issue is that the laws of succession, even if I took them seriously, have no bearing now that the empire is gone. Now Putin has done much to restore it. But of course, it can't, you know, it's not as it was in 1910. Putin's probably done as well as any man could. I mean, the one big thing I disagree with him on is this veneration of the Red Army in World War II. But you really, as a Russian, you can't really blame him for that. So much of the Soviet ideology was based on the victory in World War II, which, as I've mentioned, has nothing to do with the Cold and really has to do with their own massive productive capability, which, of course, came from the West. It's kind of hard to blame Russians since they were invaded, despite it was very obviously a preemptive attack. That has nothing to do with the average Russian person, though. And the massive loss of life that resulted, at least partially from Stalin's own actions. But he's incorrect to venerate the Red Army and therefore the Stalinist idea by not only supporting that, but passing laws to protect it. I do disagree with him vehemently about that, but that's okay. No one's perfect. It is a major flaw, though. But, you know, generally speaking, he's probably done as well as anyone could in a very short period of time. There are the basic laws of the Russian Empire and the so-called house rules, which I'm trying to tell these people have no relationship to anything today. Laws and protocols don't operate in times of chaos. in times of extreme decay, in times of you know, the you know, when everything is decaying around you, don't, you know, cite picky laws to me. But in some cases, the basic laws of the empire are put above the canons. I mean, look, you have the 72nd canon of the Sixth Ecumenical Council says that it's unworthy for an Orthodox husband to marry a heretical wife, or an Orthodox wife to combine with a heretical husband. It's considered cohabitation. It's adultery in the true sense. It says it mixed what shouldn't be mixed. The sheep and the wolf. Those people who maintain that will be excommunicated. But of course, Romanov did that all the time. And these debates over the succession, you will never hear me do a show on the succession to the Russian throne, because it's ridiculous, it's incredibly complicated, and really irrelevant. And it implies the idea that somehow the Romanovs have this eternal right to rule, which no family does. Even the 10th canon of the Council of Laodicea, it shall not be permitted to aggregate Orthodox people, sorry, I'm translating this as I'm looking at it, to marriage with heretics. The 14th canon of the 6th Ecumenical Synod, same thing in relation to the clergy. And if that's the case, then in relation to the monarch. But that's not the only requirement. It's not just formally being a member, but it's living that life. The spouse of a monarch has to be blameless, can't be a public sinner. And a moral test takes place before the betrothal. And there are many obstacles that it could be uncovered. Of course, this wasn't done. But this applies to everybody, not just to royalty. And of course, there's no such thing as a consecrated marriage with heretics. There's nothing sacred about it. It's recognized, and even legally so in Byzantium. But it's something slightly above cohabitation. Now, divorce and orthodoxy can only exist for two reasons: adultery and heresy. Otherwise, there is no divorce. I don't care what the state says. If you're married in the Orthodox Church and someone gets a civil divorce, you're not divorced. The state didn't marry you. The state can't divorce you. The state has no right to talk about divorce or marriage anyway. I don't know what people can somehow venerate the state in that area. The church has this role. This, of course, is a medieval idea. But there's many claimants to the Russian throne. I was in New York City, and I got a beautiful Russian imperial flag from George Mihailovich. This is a long time ago. Today, George is an oligarch. He has a law firm called Romanov and Partners, with two Fs, not a V. And it specializes in assisting companies dealing with EU regulations. It makes no mention of the fact that he's a Romanov claimant. None. And they spell it differently, so there is no connection. Essentially, what he does is he builds these powerful, for powerful people, he, you know, sets them up with other powerful people to bring them through the EU, system. Even though the Moscow Patriarchate in New York, still legitimately says that he is the claimant. The Romanov Family Association exists and it adheres to the fiction that Nicholas abdicated the throne. I've spent some time on that. I have a book on the subject. He never abdicated. That's a fiction, and that's a forgery. But they also believe that in this alleged abdication, he deferred to the provisional government. And this comes from Nicholas Romanovich Romanov, who's a descendant of Tsar Nicholas I. This man, during the war, World War II, he worked for the Allies in the Psychological Warfare Division in the United States Information Service. He died in 2014. The guy that everyone talks about is Kirill Vladimirovich, who died in 1938, the son of Grand Duke Vladimir Alexandrovich, who was the grandson of Alexander II, so he'd be the first cousin of Nicholas II. And during the February Revolution, he swore his fealty to the provisional government. Grand Duke Kirill married his first cousin, Princess Victoria of Saxe-Coburg, in defiance of Tsar Nicholas's prohibition. And the marriage caused a scandal. Not to mention, Victoria was divorced from her first husband, Ernst Ludwig of Hesse. Also her first cousin, by the way. The Grand Duke of Hesse's sister was the Tsarina's, the Grand Duke of Hesse's sister was Tsarina Alexandra, wife of Nicholas II. So she was one of the reasons that there was this opposition to the marriage in the court. And so was the Dowager Empress Maria. And when he came back to Russia, the Tsar stripped Kirill of his imperial allowance and titles. He was in the Navy, he stripped him of that, and he banished him. Blatant defiance. But all of this applies to anyone, not just members of the Romanovs. The Kirilloviches don't have a claim, even if all this stuff was true, even if all the Romanov stuff was true. You know, the dynastic law is ridiculously difficult to understand, and I don't necessarily want to go into it too much. Defining words like agontic or semisalic. But the concern with legalism is very stupid. The dynasty of Boris Godunov was orthodox and legitimate. The issue is faith, nationalism, dedication to Russian interests. That's what matters. That's what justifies rule under Zemensky Sobor. And this is the nature of succession and really in any Orthodox country. In Orthodoxy, everything is sanctified, including blood. But the attention is based on the personality. It's not just blood, which is part of the natural order, but the supernatural order. And there is a testing of each candidate for office, for the clergy. The same goes for the throne. In Byzantium, they overthrew emperors for this reason, that they lost the charisma of power. And the truth is the Romanovs were not worthy of their calling. You know, you hear about other Romanovs, Nikolai Romanovich, and really no one complies with the requirements of the law of succession, even if you take it seriously. All of these guys are oligarchs. I don't know where their money comes from. If you look at all the claimants to the Russian throne, they're all extremely wealthy and are a part of very powerful businesses throughout Europe. But really, there's not a single Orthodox royal house. I mean, the Greek, Romanian, Bulgarian, to a lesser extent, Balkan dynasties really retain the name. And many of them are Masonic. And you could find descendants of the Romanovs in every house of Europe. But none of them fulfill any requirements of rule. Most are oligarchs working for the major banks. And almost all of them support trendy ideology. I mean, just a man who I respect to some extent, the president, Alexander Karadjordjevich. This is what his official biography says. His Royal Highness, Alexander, has always been a very ardent defender of democracy and human rights. In 1989, he took a very active role in helping his people shake off the legacy of decades of dictatorship and the regime. During the next decade, the Crown Prince conducted numerous meetings and maintained constant contact with the democratic opposition and Democrats throughout the former Yugoslavia. In November of 1999, Crown Prince Alexander convened a large conference in Budapest for the representatives of the democratic opposition in Serbia. Crown Prince Alexander has been a tireless contributor in the process of cooperation and unity among democratic political parties. to make his homeland a great democracy for all citizens regardless of political belief, religion, or ethnic origin. If you go to his website, he lists John Stuart Mill's On Liberty as his one of his favorite books. In fact, he has a text of it on there. His son, Prince Philip, I'm reading here from his official biography, Prince Philip worked for ICOS, a global systematic hedge fund in Cyprus. He's now working with a renowned global asset manager in London. Prince Philip speaks English, Spanish, French, and is continuing with his Serbian studies. I'm happy he's continuing with his Serbian studies. He is, you know, in the royal family, after all. If you look at the Crown Cabinet and other institutions connected to the monarchy, they're all connected either to Harvard University, the Depos Coalition, and elite banks. But they are related to the Romanov line. The Karadjordjevits are related to the Romanov line, because Alexander is a great-grandson of Marie of Romania, who's a daughter of the Grand Duchess Maria Alexandrova, who herself was the aunt of Kirill Vladimirovich, the father of Vladimir Kirillovich, and therefore the grandfather of Maria. Now, this has no real moral relevance, though. Some of these guys even talk about Prince Michael of Kent. Most of these people, you know, don't have... I mean, I'm not necessarily talking about Alexander. I mean, Alexander of Serbia did serve in the British Army. I know I have friends of mine who are supportive of him. Maybe he's doing things on the side that he's not talking about. I don't know. But with this kind of ideology and being essentially oligarchs, they really don't have any claim. It's a stupid discussion. This simply can't be. Not to mention the fact that the whole notion of the Zemensky Sobor is largely gone. We're really at an impasse here. I don't care how many Zemstva in the post-Soviet era you conduct, they will be fraudulent. The Zemensky Sobor is a local council. It's meant to bring about the best, strong, the most rational, God-fearing, it says. People from all walks of life. But how many of those exist? In these conditions of turmoil, who would they represent? And what church? No claimant to the throne can come from the Moscow Patriarchate, in my opinion. They're part of the World Council of Churches. The church is intensely fragmented, and most royalists are not part of the MP, although the royal houses are. But the truth comes from, again, the Old Testament, and you have judges, not just the line of David. So the point of all of this has been, number one, the anathema of 1613, which comes up all the time in royalist circles, can't really be brought up. Number two, that this relies on the assumption that the Romanovs have this inherent right to rule because of the name. Three, even if that were true, the history of the Romanov line is a disastrous one for Russia. Despite many of the great things that were done by Elizabeth, Paul, Alexander, and Nicholas II, and Nicholas II, of course, chief among them, who kind of redeemed everybody through his death, despite all that, the Romanovs brought Russia to a state of, morally speaking, the church, especially the aristocracy, to decay. Yes, the economy did very well. Workers did very well. The cost of living, from that point of view, things went very well, especially in the second half of the 19th century. That is very true. You're talking about Alexander II, of course, Nicholas I before him, and then Alexander III and his son Nicholas. That was almost a redemption for what happened in the 18th century, despite Alexander II's personal history. The point I'm trying to make is, despite the negative thing, the positive things, the moral aspect and the theological aspects have been disastrous, especially in the 18th century. So even if all that is true, it can't possibly apply to the Romanovs. They violated their own anathema. And finally, debate over the succession with all these different people. There's right now, I think, about, well, I mean, since 1917, there's been about 50 claimants. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of, you know, relatives all over the place. They all seem to be oligarchs. None of them seem to be particularly Orthodox, although they're formally members of the church, all Moscow Patriarchate, of course. I know of no claimant part of a TOC jurisdiction. That's irrelevant anyway. That has nothing to do with succession. That has nothing to do with legitimate rule. And Metropolitan Vitali says it. He talks about, you know, military rule and as something that has somewhat of a shadow, something of the content. But even as Zemensky Sobor, who would be there? Yeah, Russians are better off than Americans, to say the least. I mean, you have Cossacks, you do have people who can be there, but it wouldn't be, you know, it would be a relatively small number, which is the case everywhere, I think. I'm not really sure. And of course, that would be taken over immediately. The Cossacks could have something to do with this. The old believers need to be involved. But I think Vladimir Putin is doing the best that anyone can do under the circumstances despite his errors. All of these claimants are very wealthy. I don't know where this money comes from. I don't want to know. And I mentioned, of course, the monarchs of Nicaea as the opposite. The suffering, struggling monarchs would rather suffer with their people than gain any kind of worldly glory. Anyway, thank you everyone for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.